On the Empire Podcast this week, we're graced by two graceful directors. Jean-Pierre Chounet swings by to talk about his new film, T.S. Spivet, while Amma Asante is a belle of the pod ball by talking about her new film, Belle, plus the usual movie news and nonsense on the only movie podcast that drew Algeria in the World Cup off a sweepstake. We might as well have formed our own bloody team. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast this week to mark the beginning of the 2014 World Cup in Brazil. We're lining up in a unique 4-0-0 formation with the overlapping podders. First up is a lady who's renowned for her drag back skills in midfield and her will to win, Chester. It's Helen O'Hara.
Wow.
Next up is a skilled and artful defender who insists on watching all football games with the subtitles turned on because it makes Andy Townsend more comprehensible. It's Phil Dissimulian. Hello.
Hello. I've got Australia. Australia in the sweepstake. Do you want to swap?
Costa Rica are still available, I think, if you want them. Helen, did you go for the sweepstake?
I didn't, no.
No?
Okay. I didn't know enough to feel like I, you know...
It's just putting your hand into a hat and pulling out some names.
Well, like, I mean, I don't want to care about it, so I figured this way I definitely won't.
You'd be no fun at, like, the tombola at the fair. I don't know enough to do this.
I need more information.
I just don't have... What am I doing here? What's the point? I'm just going to put my hand in and pull something out, am I? What is it, though? Who knows? Give me some information. Give me a brochure.
Anyway, moving on swiftly. Last but not least is a whirling dervish of energy up front. Watch out, though. Get too close, and he'll go full Suarez on your arse. Or arm. It's Ali Plum. He doesn't get that reference.
You're going to have to explain to me why I'm a pervert or something?
Not a pervert. You like to bite people. There's nothing wrong with it.
On the bum.
Give into it.
What's going on?
I don't know what's happening
this
anymore.
This is wasted on these guys.
Welcome, everybody. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Welcome. Let's discuss the questions which you guys have been sending to us all week long, like an unstoppable creepy Paddington. After the Edge of Tomorrow / All You Need Is Kill situation, where Edge of Tomorrow, which is a quite dull and nondescript title, replaced All You Need Is Kill, which is the complete opposite. What are your favourite and worst film titles? I like La Haine for grammar reasons.
What?
What does that mean?
Why?
Because it reflects the gender of the word.
Well, the hate is female.
Yeah, so he likes it because they use...
No, I don't. Let's not put words in his mouth.
But anyway, yes. Favourite or worst film titles?
If has four dots after it.
Yes. I always wonder about that.
It has a four-dot ellipsis. Why? Yeah. Why? Why if?
That is such an interesting question. I wrote the review for the Blu-ray re-release recently, and I wanted to find out. This is a bad bit of storytelling, isn't it? Because I didn't find out. I thought I would try and find out, but I didn't know who to ask, so I just got on, wrote the review, and didn't mention it. But I would love to know why there's four dots in that ellipsis. And sometimes you see it with three, and I always have a bit of a moment.
And worse, Who Framed Roger Rabbit has no question mark. If it had a question mark, that would be one of the great titles. As it is, it's just really upsetting.
Maybe who is the person who framed Roger Rabbit? So maybe it's a statement rather than a question.
Wow. That is a theory that I'm just going to leave. Okay, so my favourite titles would be, generally speaking, I was writing some of them down, and they're generally slightly long-winded and slightly weird. Back to the Future is probably the shortest and most famous example, but that used to bake my noodle as a kid. I was like, I don't understand how you can go back to the future. That's crazy. Of course, then I saw the film and it all became clear. I like sort of slightly mysterious titles for my thrillers, things like The Third Man or Hidden, I think are good titles. And then I like just weird ones, The Man with One Red Shoe, The Man in the White Suit, The Long Kiss Goodnight, The Long Good Friday. Mm. I Know What You Did Last Summer, I think, is a great title, pity about the film. And Heathers, just at the shorter end of the spectrum. That's a weird title, but one that always struck my interest, even when I had no idea what the film was about.
I like Bad Day at Black Rock. That's a good one. Picnic at Hanging Rock. That's another good one. Basically, you put rock in your title, I will like it.
The Rock.
The Rock. Yes, love it. How many mads are there in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World? Officially, how many are there?
Four, I think.
Four? It's a Mad, 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 Mad World? Okay, let's go with that.
I love In Bruges, and if I can channel Graham Garden here, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Is Bitter Taste of Artichokes, is that an actual film?
No, that's an office joke that somebody made up.
Okay, because I think I like
But
that.
The Tree of Wooden Clogs is an actual film.
Yes, that's one of Mike Lee's top 10 films. I like Danger Diabolique. Ace in the Hole.
Oh, yeah.
Some Like It Hot.
Yes.
These are good. Why is it called Some Like It Hot?
Well, Some Like It Hot. She actually says the line in the film.
Also, Nobody's Perfect.
Absolutely, which is another film.
God, this is all feeding into itself.
Full Metal Jacket is good. I think that was one Kubrick found, because it's based on the Short Timers, right? Yes. By Gus Halford, is it? But he didn't like that. And so he was flicking through some sort of gun. I think he was must have been a subscriber to Guns and Ammo. But he just found this term and he quite liked it, and it fits so perfectly.
Die Hard's a good title. The book that Die Hard is based on is called Nothing Lasts Forever. It's not a good book. But Die Hard's a much better title than that.
Both of those and several others are actually in a feature on the website at the moment, which is about books that had their titles changed for the big screen.
Oh, really?
So those are just two of the examples. I mean, you can guess lots of the others that are in there, obviously. But things like Tangled and Frozen as well. All the Philip K. Dick ones, pretty much. Uh-huh.
Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key. Never seen the film, but it's a cracking title. Also, Don't Be a Menace to South Central while drinking your juice in the hood, which sounds so great coming out of my mouth. And then, of course, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, which I rewatched recently for reasons that are probably obvious. There Will Be Blood. It's so useful for punning. There Will Be Flood was the title of our Noah feature. So at least there's that. Fight Club, Death Proof, Doctor Strangelove, and Lock Stock.
I love titles that, as with Die Hard, they were changed from originals. The original just wouldn't have been as good. I love The Shawshank Redemption, which is obviously based on a Stephen King novella, which is called Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption. There's no "the," there's no definite article there. It's just Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption. And I just don't think that would have flown somehow. But did you know the original title of Alien, as written by Dan O'Bannon, was Star Beast? Can you imagine people going to see a film called Star Beast? It doesn't trip off the tongue for me. Alien is just so perfect.
Star Beast Resurrection, Star Beasts.
Yes.
It doesn't sound quite as good. Star Beasts, The Power of Three.
Yeah, Star Beast versus Dreadlocked Alien thingy.
Prometheus Beast.
I'm never quite sure who decides when we translate a film title and when we don't. Like, is it a Buddha souffle or breathless?
Or about a souffle.
Or about a souffle.
About a boy that everyone loves.
Yeah, about a souffle.
Is it sort of souffle rather than souffle?
A Buddha souffle. I don't know. A Buddha souffle. Because Das Boot would be no good if you just went wrong. Have you seen The Boat? It's great.
Yeah, that doesn't work.
Doesn't really.
Have you seen The Boot?
Like, Plein Soleil is something that you would see 100 times before you'd ever go and see something called Purple Noon, which is how it was released in this country.
Yeah.
So there's something to be said for keeping it sometimes. And even Hidden or Caché, you know, I think I'd go for the original French title.
What about other grammatical blunders like Star Trek Into Darkness, which is still weird? And 2 weeks notice with no apostrophe, and ladies man with no apostrophe, and the 40-year-old virgin without enough hyphens.
30 minutes or less. Should have been 30 minutes or fewer.
Or law-abiding citizen, which doesn't have an apostrophe.
Yeah.
I mean hyphen. This is a surprisingly long list.
Interesting enough, maybe telling a tale out of school. It's quite interesting. Last month we ran a set history report on Monsters, Dark Continent, which is the sequel, the follow-up really, to Gareth Edwards' Monsters. As we were going to press, I noticed that we'd put it through. It was in my section, so it was going through as Monsters, Dark Continent, all running onto each other, no colon. It wasn't Monsters, colon, Dark Continent. And I went, hang on, this is weird. And Dan, who wrote the feature, went, no, that's what the film company want. And I went, no, it looks weird. Can you let them know that we think this looks weird? And so Dan got in touch with them and said, this doesn't look right. And as a result, they changed it. They changed it to Monsters, colon,
Dark
Continent. It's
not called
Monsters 2. So now that's the power of Empire, people. We can change a film's name.
Duck Soup's a good one. I'm a big fan of Duck Soup.
Great title.
I wondered, though, lastly, the Jules Légime. Why is it Jules Légime and not Jules Légime A?
The other one.
The other one.
The patriarchy.
Yeah.
That was specifically set up for Helen to finish with the word patriarchy.
Here we go. All right.
I got patriarchy in the sweepstake for this podcast.
Really?
Yeah, so I clear up.
Drinking game. Okay, that's your question answered, John C.N. Harris. As ever, this is not an exhaustive list. We're coming up with this stuff off the top of our heads. Here we go. Question from @TonySpurs81. I wonder who he supports. Question for next week's show, as in this week's show. Best football films. Hooray! Excluding hooligan ones. Boo. He says Escape to Victory. Maybe he was just asking me if I wanted to Escape to Victory, but I think he was suggesting Escape to Victory.
It's a film about everything. Oh, crikey, there aren't that many great football films, are there?
No.
If we're honest.
No.
I don't think there are any.
Once you get past Goal and Goal 2, Living the Dream.
But yeah, Escape to Victory does tend to... I do weep when I watch that. The music, even the music, just sets me off. And Pele's overhead kick and the Ozil Diles... not Scorpion Kick. He does that
the
flick
rainbow
over
flick.
There. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you spent about half an hour trying to persuade him to do it again at the photo shoot.
Yeah.
But he pointed out that if he did try and do it again, like, one of his legs might fall off.
He would die.
But you were like, never mind that, Ozzy, get on with it.
Yeah. We can rebuild you.
Yes, exactly. Goal, no. Bedknobs and Broomsticks has a cracking football match.
It does.
Subsea Tiki-Taka.
It does. It does.
That's all I've got on football.
Otherwise, yeah, there's not really an awful lot. I think, Helen, you're actually going to come in and win this one because I don't think there aren't any great football films. The way there are great baseball films and great American football films. And
next goal wins.
Bend It Like Beckham is actually better than a lot of it football is. Movies. And it I know is. It has a its reputation has kind of gone downhill since it came out and everybody went nuts for it. But yeah, I mean, it's a weird thing. I think sometimes the least fun sports to watch in real life, unless you're more upset, you know, more worried about the hot dogs and the accoutrements of the sport, make the better films to watch on screen. Weirdly, there are endless great basketball and baseball movies, as you say, and like hardly any for any of the great sports here. Tennis as well, no great tennis movies. Don't give me Wimbledon, really, please don't.
Space Jam, are you saying?
I'm not saying Space Jam, no.
For basketball.
But the likes of Hoop Dreams, Coach Carter is a perfectly decent film. Basketball is perhaps not the best.
There are good documentaries about football.
Great. Yeah, there are some good documentaries.
There was a very good one about the New York Cosmos a few years back. Yep. There's this new FIFA one, which sounds like it's actually a feature film, isn't it? About the it's a sort of Sepp Blatter origin story.
Oh, that
story.
One. That I think
that
it's
sounds
like,
awful.
It's like the Darth Maul kind of backstory.
Yeah, we can safely say, sight unseen, that film. Have you seen the trailer?
Yes.
It's so bad.
I want to watch it, and I think we should review it on this podcast.
When Sam Neill was in, did we ask him about that?
Sadly, no. Sorry.
We didn't?
Oh, no. Is he in it?
Because he plays Xiao Havelange, who is the sort of, I think, one of the founders of FIFA, or one of the big noises of FIFA before Sepp Blatter. But yeah.
I'd also like to put in a word here for, I wouldn't say this is a great football movie, please don't think that I did, but She's the Man. Has Amanda Bynes pretend to be her own twin brother so that she can go and play football with Channing Tatum at a private school. And what's fascinating to me about this film is that his lessons and her ambition is to master the windmill or the bicycle kick, I'm not sure what it's called, which in this universe is an essential component of any football player's skills.
I just remembered the greatest football film of all time.
Yeah.
Charlotte Soccer.
Okay, yeah, fair.
And that's it. And we're done. But the problem with football is very hard for actors to move like world-class football players. It's almost impossible, actually. Those guys are on a different level to everyone else. And we're so used to seeing it through this very particular prism. You know, football's presented to us in a very, very defined way, televisually, every week. It's the same shot, wherever we are, whichever stadium we are, is high up. One largely fixed shot, occasionally some close-ups. And when directors like to mess with it and they make it more cinematic and they get the camera in very up close and players are moving around, there's lots of CG and tricks and flicks, you get no sense of the geography of the game, you get no sense of where players are in relation to each other. If I look at any football film or any football advert, for example the recent Nike advert that got a lot of praise, but that advert always takes me out of the advert in a way because the CG is so dreadful. The fact that you can tell the players weren't really with each other, they weren't in the same pitch at the same time. So clearly some of them are on the green screen and they're just comped into the background later on. It just doesn't work.
No.
Football, unlike boxing, which is obviously close in and needs people punching, football is a team game. It's 22 players on a pitch and you need to be aware at all times where players are in relation to each other.
I think that's right. It is a game of geography and about, you know, about positioning and about spatial awareness in the way that boxing probably isn't, which is a close combat kind of thing, like martial arts. You can depict more easy, but where you put the camera in the football, it's impossible to get the camera in the right place. I went out on the set of Pele, a film they were going to make in time for the World Cup but didn't quite get done in time for the World Cup. As you can imagine, Lois, we'll be talking about it now in the review section.
It's a wonderful metaphor for the Brazilian World Cup, isn't it?
Yeah, everything's a little bit, yeah.
Not quite finished.
A little bit. It was shot in Rio, about Pelé's sort of origin story for Pelé, and it ends up with the World Cup in Stockholm, which was, 50... What year was that?
58.
58, exactly. We should be reviewing it this week, but it didn't quite come together in time. But I watched them playing and they got professional footballers, Brazilians, I mean really gifted footballers, and even then it's just like you've got to move so slowly and they were trying to do the same move over and over again and it just feels so kind of like rigid and regimented in a way that football is more fluid and what have you.
I just remembered the second greatest football movie of all time, Finney Jones's Mean Machine, in which Jason Statham sports the worst Scottish accent
what's his name?
He's the monk. He's the monk. And Danny Dyer's in it as well, I think. And I was on set of that movie. It's literally just come back to me. I was on set. It was one of the first things I ever did for Empire. And I was on set and I got to watch them do a football match. I got to watch the Stath in goals. It's the first time I ever met the Staithe. It's a glorious memory for both of us, I'm sure. It was, you know, jumping around, leaping around like he'd never seen a goalkeeper before in his life. It was an exquisite, glorious day. I got to talk to Finney Jones, a man who broke my heart in 1988. But anyway, that's another tale for another time.
There's football at the beginning of Battleship, that terrible film Battleship, isn't it?
Yeah.
With an overhead kick.
Yeah, they love that in America. That honestly, every football scene in an American film seems to feature that kind of, yeah, you know, whatever that's called, that kick.
My favourite thing about the World Cup, leaving movies aside, is my mum, who's American, and she loves watching. She doesn't really understand football particularly, but she just, I mean, she always talks about, like, the guy in goal is like the cage tender. Who's the guy in cage for England? It's that guy from Shampoo Adverts, isn't it? And she'll be like, oh, he's on the bike. What are you talking about? On the bike. Score.
Amazing.
Anyway, so that's going to be great. Love you, Mum.
Okay, so that's Tony Spurs 81's question answered. And now let's have a question that Ali, who's just been staring at us for the last 10 minutes, might actually be able to contribute to. This is from @PHAJess, who asks, I need a film-related name for my new cat. Currently, Chewbacca and R2 is on the list. Suggestions, please.
Donnie, as in shut the fuck up, Donnie. Satanico Pandemonium.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's good for a cat.
Rizzo, as in Rizzo the Rat.
Yeah.
The Bride.
Yes.
And finally, Pussy Galore.
Yes, obvious, but good, good. From Dusk Till Dawn, it's pretty fertile, isn't it? You could call your cat Sex Machine and get away with it. I think that'd be okay.
I think that'd be wrong. I would suggest Toothless or Stitch, mm-hmm. both of whom have cat-like qualities. I like Cyrano and Fezzik, because it sounds fuzzy.
Aww.
If it was a big cat, that would fit really well.
Aww.
The cat in the Long Goodbye, it was actually called, not in the film, but it was actually called Chauncey Scratchit.
Really?
Yes.
That's
so
amazing.
Yeah, that's a good one. And I met someone last night whose dog is called Zizou, and I think that's quite a cool name, and he said it would be okay for that, for PHJS. Potentially to use that for the cat if they'd like. I think Zizou's quite a cool name for a cat.
I think Pazuzu's a good name for a cat as well.
Zool.
Yeah, Zool, also good.
What
yeah.
about Deja Vu off the Matrix?
What about Deja Vu of the Matrix?
What about Deja Vu of the Matrix?
I do like it though. I hope we helped there, PHJS. I think we could probably go on all day saying silly names for movies, but I think we gave you about 85 million to choose sure. from there. So let us know what you went for.
I would go for Soap.
Soap.
Just call it Soap.
Soap the cat.
From Lock, Stock.
Oh, that's not bad. Time now for our first guest. Jean-Pierre Chounet is the brilliant director of some of the most unforgettable and visually lavish films of the last 20 years, from Delicatessen to Amelie. He's back this week with T.S. Spivet, his first fully English language movie since Alien Resurrection. And we sent Phil and Helen along recently to speak to him. No?
Absolutely.
Oui.
Well, welcome to the Empire Podcast, and we're joined today by Jean-Pierre Jeunet.
Hello.
Hello. So your new film is The Young and Prodigious T.S. Spivet, which is a fantastic title in itself.
A little bit long.
A little bit long, a little bit hard to pronounce sometimes.
Yeah, but everybody will say Spivet,
yes.
Like they said Amelie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is a much longer title, which nobody uses.
Yeah.
So, this is a very American story. It's this kind of fantastical, you know, American, dream America, really, like a dream of America. But and you made it completely outside the USA, which I find
Yeah, completely, yeah. But, you know, you never avoid completely American. You have to deal with the American agent, the worst liar in the world. And, but it's important for me. It's not an American movie. It's a fake American movie. It's a French and Canadian co-production. Why? To keep the freedom. That's the most important thing for me, the freedom. And I made 7 films, including Alien Resurrection. Alien was a parenthèse. It was special. It was a different role of the game. But, by the way, I am pretty proud about the film. I kept the freedom somewhere because I stay positive. They respect me. Of course, I had to fight, to struggle, but it's my film. I am proud about the film. But the 6 French film, I had the complete freedom. I never made any compromises, and I'm very proud about that. So the last one is the same. Even if it's supposed to be American, it's a French film.
T.S. Spivet is adapted from a book by a novelist
yes.
called... Forgive my pronunciation if I've messed it up. Reef Larson?
Yes,
is that
Reef
correct?
Larson, yeah.
And I saw an email that he sent where I guess the studio had asked him which directors he would like potentially to direct it. And your name was obviously on a list with Alfonso Cuarón and Guillermo del Toro. I think Wes Anderson
David
was on
Fincher,
there as well.
David Fincher, Wes Anderson,
yeah,
Tim
it was
Burton.
Tim Burton.
Yeah. Luckily, I was the first to call. And he couldn't believe him. He thought it was a joke. And yeah, we made a Skype and I explained, no, I really want to make the film. And it's funny because we are very close in terms of spirit. When he saw Amélie, he told me, I had the feeling someone scratched on my head. And when we had the first meeting in New York, he gave me a gift. It was a photograph book. And I gave this book to my friend 1 week before. We had exactly the same feeling, you know. Yes. He could be my son somewhere.
Oh.
Yeah, so he's 40, he's very young.
Was his writing inspired by your films?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. And it was in the book, it was some details. I avoid to put it in the film because it was too close to Amélie. So I cut it.
Really? Can you elaborate? Anything in particular that was...
No, I don't remember, but some joke, some view on the world. It was exactly the spirit of Amélie.
Please tell me, Jean-Pierre, that there will be a special T.S. Spivet Viewmaster tie-in product.
I don't know.
Can we get one of those? That would be
when
amazing.
When we ask Viewmaster to have the possibility to show it, they said no. And we said, it's an homage. You don't believe it? You don't understand. It's an homage. And they said yes at the end. It's at the beginning of the credits.
Yes, beautiful credit sequence in the film. Don't move. Don't leave your seat.
Definitely. Oh, yeah. It drives me crazy when the theater turn on the light during the credits.
I wanted to ask as well about casting Helena Bonham Carter, because I read that you met her on set of Fight Club.
Exactly.
Which you were shooting with David Fincher. So, I mean, how did you guys meet? Was that through the Alien connection?
Yeah, exactly. When I arrived in LA, I called David and he told me, leave, run. It was a nightmare to make Alien. But for him, it was a real nightmare. For me, it wasn't a nightmare. It wasn't easy every day. But
why was it a nightmare for him but not for you? Because
when they started to shoot, they didn't add any script. So they built some sets and they didn't know if it could be possible to shoot inside. So it was a real nightmare.
But he always talked about having studio executives on set all the time.
Yes.
Over his shoulder. You must have had a similar...
No. I was free. They weren't here. No, I had almost the complete freedom. But the pressure was much more for the money, strangely. Less shot, less takes. One beautiful shot on three, it will be enough. All the time they, put the pressure to save money.
How was your relationship with Joss Whedon, the screenwriter?
Joss Whedon, at this time, he was very proud about the film during the release. And now he's split on the film. Because he says he trahison. It's and it makes me laugh because it's sexual, it's funny, and it's not enough stupid action movie. And now Joss Whedon does some stupid action movie with superhero. I couldn't watch it. It's too silly. I am very proud about that. In France, it was very well received. It was amazing. It was exactly the opposite. I was like the champions of the Olympic Games because I made a film in Hollywood. It was silly in another way because it was too much. It was just a sequel, guys.
You were linked with Harry Potter. How close did you come to making a Harry Potter movie?
Yeah, it was very serious because Warner loved very long engagement. They produced it. And it was a meeting in Paris around a table in a good restaurant. And it was very serious. David Eman was here. And I had just to say yes. And they expected that. And I said, I'm tired. I have to think. Give me 1 month to think. you don't say that when they offer Harry Potter. So after 2 weeks, they say, we need an answer. We need to start right now. And I said, right now, I need vacation, guys, or I'm going to die. So, and I didn't feel like to make that. Why? Because everything was ready. The costume design, the production design, the casting, everything was on the table. I had just to shoot.
Yes.
And I love to create a world to make the production design. I love that.
Well, they're making this kind of Harry Potter spin-off set 70 years before. I mean, you could maybe have a go at that.
What?
They're making a Harry Potter kind of related film, a spin-off, which is set something like 70 or 80 years before Harry Potter, so like 1920s or something, and it's going to be wizards but sort of jazz age.
Okay.
Three more Harry Potter movies. With the monsters and the creatures and maybe a steampunk 1920s.
Really?
Would you be interested?
I don't know. It depends on the script.
Okay. We have to ask about Amélie. And the news that it's going to be potentially a Broadway musical, I know that it's not something that you immediately had a lot of fondness for that idea.
Yeah, I hate
it. Is there anything that they could do that would win you over to the idea of it?
No, I refused during 12 years. Mm. I hate musical. I think that's the most tacky thing on earth. But at the end, I thought, do I have the right to refuse some money? Because with money, I can save kids. With some people, they made some heart surgery operation, you know, to save kids. So the money will be for that. If it's a success, if it's a flop, it will be a disaster.
I gather they're removing the score, the accordion music and the Parisian motifs and having an American style.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I don't care. I don't want to know anything. I told them, don't invite me. I don't want to see. I don't want to know anything.
What about Life of Pi as well? Because I was reading an interview with you where you were actually referring to it as my last film.
Yeah,
because you got so far down the road that, you know, it was like...
Yeah, just it was too expensive. They didn't want to spend more than $60 million and the budget was 85. So they offered me to produce the film myself. We made some research in Europe, in Studio Alicante in Spain. We study the waves machine, we make location scouting in India. I made the whole storyboard, 4 months, you know, a big, huge work. And we were at 59 million, but in euro. In euro dollar, it was exactly the same thing. So I gave up. I said, okay, now I have to shoot 2 years, you know. And I told them in 3 years, if you are waiting 3 years, we will be able to make the tiger in CGI. And they did, but with Angli. And they spent $150 million.
Wow.
But Taiwan pay half of the film. This is a secret. Because Angli is friend with the President de la République of Taiwan. It's not my case. I don't know him.
You're not friends with any presidents?
No. But he made a great work. The part in the ocean, it's great because he had so much money. But the adaptation is a copy-paste of the book. And our adaptation was a real adaptation. I think it was much better.
Yeah, the ending of Ang Lee's Life of Pi, people said that it was a little spelt out in terms of the fact that it had been a big metaphor. Yeah. Was yours, how was yours
different?
Yeah,
but we made something clever because we had the doubt because it was a concept in the novel. But in the middle of the film, the kid, the tiger lose, comment dit griffe, a claw. A claw. And at the end, the old man open a letter with the claw. So you know it was true, a true story. Oh. It was a small detail. It was a good idea.
Yeah. Wow.
What is next for you then? Do you know yet?
For the next, I'm thinking about something less expensive. It's possible because now with the crisis, it's getting difficult. And something, maybe in the future, science fiction less expensive. Can you believe it?
Wow, that is unbelievable.
And maybe with Elena one more time.
Wow.
Yeah.
You started out studying animation and you made some animation short movies. Yeah. Have you ever been tempted to, because I know Pixar is a studio you admire very much. Yeah. Have you ever been tempted to do a feature-length animation?
I met a guy, he won this year the Oscar for a French animation short film. He's French. And he wants to work with me, so I'm going to help him. I don't know exactly in which way, but I try to help him to make a feature.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What, can you give us any of the kind of themes or subject matter?
Look at the short film, Monsieur Hublot.
Oh, I see. So it'll be a feature-length version of that?
Yeah, and it will be in the same spirit.
I was going to ask, because I know you went sort of, you described it as going on pilgrimage to the set of, was it NYPD Blue when you were in the States? So is that the show that you would go on pilgrimage to nowadays?
No. Number one is Breaking Bad for me. But some people ask me why you don't make a TV show, but I think to write one film, it's a big deal for me, but to write 60 or 70 films, I don't know how they do. Of course, they have some teams, but I don't know. It's a nightmare for me.
Before we let you go, I just wondered, I mean, your films are known for, they are decorated with amazing props and amazing kind of Heath Robinson contraptions and there's so much kind of fun devices and production design. Do you keep the things that, I mean, would you have the sea dog figure, for instance?
Yes,
from,
of course.
Do you keep all of those things?
I keep all objects. My office in Paris, in Montmartre, is a kind of museum about myself. I have everything, the alien, the lamping of family, The beautiful wooden end in the long engagement, some a lot of stuff, yeah.
And when are you going to open that to the public?
Yeah, I would like to make an exhibition one day, but in France they don't care.
Really?
I have some proposition from Melbourne, from Sao Paulo, but it's far. I don't want to lend my stuff during 2 years. It's too far.
You can come here.
Yeah,
right?
Here
it's pretty close.
Not bad, but I have no proposition.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah, any museums?
I have so many objects. It's rare. Usually in an exhibition, it's paper, photograph, poster. I have so many objects.
And we could see your Life of Pi, at least in storyboard form.
Yeah, I have the whole storyboard and the model. We built a model with a kid and the tiger, like for an animation film. I took maybe 3,500 pictures, and we redrew everything. Huge work.
Wow.
Oh, amazing. Well, yeah. Fingers crossed that will one day happen, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right, Jean-Pierre Chounet, done. He's in the bag, out the way. Let's talk about movie news. What we got? What happened this week in the world of Hollywood? Helen?
Well, after all the to-ing and fro-ing last week about Ant-Man, the situation has been somewhat solidified, clarified, and generally fied.
Our situation has not improved.
Well, perhaps. I mean, it depends on your viewpoint, I guess. The news this week is that Peyton Reed will direct Ant-Man, and Adam McKay, who had previously said he would not be directing, is nevertheless doing a rewrite on the script. So he's presumably going to funny up whatever script they now have and try and make it, I guess, more fun, one would hope. Now, Peyton Reed is the man who's best known for kind of comedy of a slightly generally offbeat sensibility. Down with Love, which I think is a great film. Mm-hmm. Yes Man, which was fine. I didn't love as much. But it isn't his first flirtation with superheroes. He was down to direct the original Fantastic Four. And the idea,
right,
I think, at that point was it was going to be a sort of swinging 60s kind of rather groovy take on the Fantastic Four in the way that Down with Love was, which actually would have been a really interesting idea. So if he brings some of that kind of flavour to this, we could be onto something here.
Did he bring it on as well? Or am I just making that up?
No, he did, yeah.
He did, okay.
Yeah. And that's fun.
Yeah, so, you know, people are ragging on this choice, largely because there's still a lot of soreness over the Edgar Wright situation.
Absolutely.
You know, but I guess Marvel have to move on at some point. We all have to move on with our lives at some point. But yeah, he's fine. He's probably one of the better choices of the people who were linked with this afterwards. Adam McKay would have been fine, I think, for whatever reason he chose not to take it. But do the rewriting gig, okay, fair enough. Ruben Fleischer, whose stock has fallen dramatically for me, saw him be like, was great. 30 minutes or less, sorry, fewer, was pretty bad, and Gangster Squad was awful. So I'm glad he didn't get the job. And Russell Marshall Thurber, I don't know. At least Peyton Reed has some visual flair. Some. Down with Love is a really fun film, looks really nice,
yeah.
Very sappy, sharp script, and so I think he could handle it as well. Edgar Wright's such a big loss in this project, but
yeah, he is.
Who knows what happens? Who knows what?
The other thing is that they released an official synopsis for the film, which now goes: armed with the astonishing ability to shrink in scale but increase in strength, con man Scott Lang, played by Paul Rudd, must embrace his inner hero and help his mentor, Dr. Hank Pym, who's of course Michael Douglas, protect the secret behind his spectacular Ant-Man suit from a new generation of towering threats. Against seemingly insurmountable obstacles, Pym and Lang must plan and pull off a heist that will save the world. So there's been a bit of criticism of that. I know that Marvel likes to kind of mix up their genres with every superhero movie so that it's not just a superhero movie, it's something else. Of course, we had the sort of paranoia thriller with Captain America, we had the kind of big sci-fi with Thor, and Guardians indeed as well. This one is a heist film, it seems. So
cool. I mean, sounds good to me. Ant-Man's actually well suited to pulling off heists because he's a little tiny little guy. But yeah, I don't know. Fingers crossed that this one is fine. Marvel have had lots of problems with movies before in production and managed to pull it out of the fire. This one's obviously a little bit more public than most. But you know, I wish them all the best. It's sad not to feel it. You know, there is an overwhelming sense of sadness we won't get to see Edgar Wright's Vision.
Definitely.
But yeah, let's see what happens. Anyone else for any more? What else we got?
Well, you know how successful the Super Mario Bros. Movie was.
Let me just look it up in my Google calculator.
And you know how good Need for Speed went.
Just doing that as well. Also very successful.
So they're doing Sonic the Hedgehog movie. In news that's just come in from, 20 years ago, they're making a Sonic the Hedgehog movie about everyone's favourite blue, very fast hedgehog and his bifurcated tailed pal, Tails. Yes, he's a fox. I'm told he's a fox. So they're making not just a movie, but a franchise out of Sega's mascot. The plan is to make several films. It will be a mixture of live action and animation, and will probably do really, really well. It's got a huge international appeal, this character, and I get where they're coming from. I think they're seeing what happened with the Smurfs, and they want to do something similar. There is a whole roster of characters in the Sonic world who I do like, as far as they go. Knuckles was always my favourite. And I think people who played the crossover games on the Wii, where you could play, for example, the Olympics with both the Sega characters and the Nintendo characters, and the TV shows that have gone on for years and years and years, mean that he's still part of the pop culture. There's a great game called Sonic All-Stars Racing Reborn, which I love, and that did really well, kind of another Mario Kart clone, but not for Nintendo. He's still about, he's still loved, he still looks cool, he has flashy red sneakers, but... There hasn't been a good run on game to film adaptations lately, but maybe this one will pass muster.
If you're a hedgehog, where would you want to be going for casting?
I mean, how about Dave Spikey?
Do you need to be a Sonic Hedgehog, or will they train you to get?
Well, that is just his name.
Oh,
he does break the Sonic barrier sometimes when he's spinning really fast. What I'm thinking is they should make a Lord of the Rings spin-off, because obviously Sonic needs rings, so it's going to be him and Knuckles carrying him up Mount Doom, and then
lobbing him in a volcano
with that little face of his going and then everyone's saved, I guess.
Why is he blue? Is he Narvi?
Dude,
really sad.
I feel like today's podcast is really dividing us into the people who understand what the hell is going on and the people who have no clue. First we had soccer, now we have Sonic.
What did you just call it?
First we had football, and now we have Sonic, and either way it's just distressing. I was going for
British
alliteration.
Football. That's fine. Although, obviously soccer is technically correct. But nevertheless, come on, Helen.
Alliteration, Chris, come on.
Alliteration is awesome. Can I just say the Dave Spikey thing again? Because I thought that was quite clever. And the one.
What happened?
You said, who would play Sonic the Hedgehog? And I said, Dave Spikey from Phoenix Knights, because he's spiky. And hedgehogs.
Who should he go for casting, is what he said.
Where should he go for casting?
And then you said Dave Spikey, and it was like, what? He's not an agent or a casting manager.
Well, maybe he is an agent these days, but I'm just saying, if you wanted someone to play Sonic the Hedgehog, but not play as in the choice.
Oh,
all right,
no.
Let's move on.
Moving on to another blue thing. Yeah. Avatar. Avatar 2, 3, 4, and 5. Going? Stop.
No,
go
stop.
Back one.
Stop
go back one.
Stop at 4.
Stop at 4. 2, yeah. 3, and 4 have Sigourney Weaver aboard. Although, yes, she died in the first film. She's coming back as a different character. But we don't know who. But we do know that James Cameron says that Sigourney and I have a long creative history dating back to 1985 when we made Aliens, and we're good friends.
Oh,
and
that's a good point.
It just feels right that she's coming back for the Avatar sequels. That's nice. Her character of Grace Augustine, as fans know, and died in the first movie. And I suspect people that aren't necessarily fans probably know that as well, because they would have watched the movie and seen her dying. So she's playing a different and in many ways more challenging character in the upcoming films. Now, that's all we know, really. They're excited about working together again.
I think she should play Grace Augustine again, but in a Weekend at Bernie's type situation, literally she's dead for the entire three movies, and and Jake and Natiri just have to like pull her on strings and do stuff.
Let's say no. I mean, this is an interesting one, because we've already had Sam Worthington playing his own twin. That's the whole premise of the first movie. You then have Colonel Quaritch, who's already been announced to return for the sequel, despite having apparently died last time. And we've now got Sigourney Weaver. Now, of course, Sigourney Weaver's consciousness did, in theory, join Awa last time.
Yes, it did.
Remember? So she could be reborn as some kind of new thing on the planet. The fact that he says new character suggests that's not the case to me, but it must be. It's the only logical way that she would have any business coming back.
Maybe she is Mother Awa.
Maybe she will play Pandora, a weird crossover between Adrian Mole and
maybe she'll play Na'vi Sonic.
That would be amazing.
As a fan of Supernatural, You must know that nobody dies in these things. Not really. I'm guessing. But I'm guessing people have died in Supernatural and then come back to life and then died again and then come back to life.
People have died in Supernatural more than on any other show on TV and come back to life.
Including The West Wing.
Yes. I think that's probably right. There are more resurrections on Supernatural than any other show, and I would be fascinated to hear if anyone thinks differently.
Oh, that's very interesting. That's very interesting. Good question. But yeah, people die and then they come back and it's going to be awesome. And we're all very excited about Avatar 2, 3, 4. And is that it? That's definitely it, isn't he? He's stopping at 4.
Yeah, 4.
We're counting to 4. All right, excellent news. Is that it for movie news?
There was a slight mention this week that Guillermo del Toro confirmed that the Pacific Rim sequel is still in development. He is now writing it with Zach Penn, rather than Travis Beecham, who wrote the original. Beecham's now working on like three different TV shows, so it isn't available. But he's made it clear it's not going to be a prequel. It's going to be, he says, very new, very crazy, really great spectacle. But it doesn't have a green light yet. He's just working on the story. The original didn't do quite that well, or quite as well as hoped in the US, but it did do better worldwide. So it may be a go concern. So yeah. Could happen. Keep an eye out.
Cool beans indeed. And obviously, if you are going to the Edinburgh Film Festival, which starts next week in Edinburgh, I believe, there's a thing called Hero Hangouts, which is extended Q&As with some big names up there, from Noel Clarke to Don Johnson, Elijah Wood. Helen, you're doing Simon Helberg and Jocelyn Towne, his wife.
I am, yes.
Which I'm very jealous of because I'm a huge Big Bang Theory fan. And Eli Roth might be in the mix as well, and there might be some more added as well. We also have the big screening of your greatest movie of all time, and probably, if we're honest, ours as well, The Empire Strikes Back. A big old anniversary screening is going to be taking place up there with some very special guests as well, and don't forget, of course, The Empire Podcast is going live in Edinburgh June 24th, from 3:30 to 5:30 in the afternoon. Yes, it clashes with the England game. Yes, I've only just found that out. But anyway, I'm going to give it my all. I'm going to be fully committed. And tickets for that are on sale now for all the Hero Hangouts and for the Empire Strikes Back screening. So, and that's available. You can get them through the Edinburgh Film Festival website, which is www.edfilmfest.org.uk. It's a .org. Interesting. Okay, so yeah, we'd love to see you there. We know that many of you have already bought tickets to come see us at the podcast, so we're going to have some special guests for that one as well. It's going to be, as they say in Scotland, blinding. Right, time now for a second interview. Amma Asante began her career as an actress in the likes of Grange Hill, but she didn't let that stop her. She had bigger fish to fry and turned her hand to directing a few years ago. Her second film, Belle, opens this week and tells the true tale of an illegitimate mixed-race girl who's raised as an aristocrat by her great-uncle in the 18th century. Asante popped in this week to have a good old natter with Phil and Ali. Enjoy.
Tom, we're talking about Tom.
Yeah, I mean, he's closer to what he really is. He's just so nice, so sensitive. So.
And does he actually know any magic?
Yes, he does.
He does.
Tom Felton knows magic.
Awesome. Tom Felton knows magic. Tom Felton magicked Prince at our after party a week ago.
I was going to ask you about that. How?
I'm joking.
Not about that specifically, but Prince at your after party, that's a pretty good get.
You know what? I'm still sitting in a place where I can't quite believe it happened. I'm kind of like... You know, I was sitting in a reception a few minutes ago and Prince started playing on the radio, Purple Rain. And the reason why I don't have a voice now is because I was screaming it a week ago as he was singing it at our after party. And I'm going, this really happened. This really happened. Prince was like, I could literally touch him. And he said my name from the stage.
Amazing.
My name has been in his mouth.
There were several people I saw on Twitter just going, having one of those out-of-body experiences.
It really was. You know, because it was also quite late in the day where he said, you know, I'd like to host a party. And do you think more people would come if I played? Oh, my God, he came out. He's beautiful. Mm. He's absolutely beautiful. And he came out and he was kind of, yeah, he had this fro. And I was like, oh, my God, he looks so cool. And guess what? He had a T-shirt on with the painting that inspired our... film. It's so cool.
That's amazing. Did he play bat dance?
No, he didn't. As I remember, he didn't play bat dance. I wasn't drunk, but I was having an out-of-body experience, and he played so many songs. I don't remember him playing bat dance, but he did say, this is what he said, do you know how many hits I have? we could be here all night. And we were like, yes.
Go on then.
Yes, we're ready to stay here till 6 a.m. It was just that great.
I need to see a photograph of him wearing that shirt.
Yeah, we're all saying that. I mean, they asked us to not take photos and we all, of course, respected that. So there is nothing that's tweetable.
Darn. You mentioned the portrait that inspired Bell. Somebody sent it to you on a postcard, I believe.
Yeah.
Is this going to spark a sort of flurry of postcards of things coming through your letterbox, of people wanting you to,
you know,
make their sort of their holiday, you know, resort into a movie, or what have you?
What I'm getting, rather than postcards and paintings, what I'm getting is lots of, I've unearthed this story from 18th century, I don't know, Mongolia. Would you like to tell this story? And so I'm getting a lot of 18th century stories being told to me. And my agent has said, Emma, we will not have you as the director known as the filmmaker who makes women in bonnets, you know, who's only pointing a camera at women in bonnets for the whole time. I said, there wasn't one bonnet in the movie. but yeah, this idea that, I mean, there is that thing that you kind of become locked in the idea that your movie of the moment is kind of portraying you as. And that's why I'm going on to do something completely different, you know, completely contemporary and completely different after this.
It sounds very mysterious, this project.
It's called Unforgettable, working title, because I know that you guys at Empire, if you don't like the movie, the first line will be, this movie is so forgettable. So we are going to not keep that title. I've begged them. It's Warner Brothers. It's a thriller. It's a real fun piece. It's something I haven't written. I'm working, you know, as the director with a writer, and this is really great because it's just an interesting way to work the Hollywood system. And it's a double female lead.
And
A-list lead.
The casting hasn't been announced yet, but I understand you have Oscar winners.
Yes, that's quite right.
Are they any of the following people?
No.
Meryl Streep. Jennifer Lawrence. Oh.
the face,
not a thing.
The face of stone.
Do you want me to get fired before I even make my first Hollywood movie?
Of course we don't want that to happen.
For goodness sake.
No.
I mean, I have to go and make my name in Hollywood so that I can come back here and carry on with my independent films. This is very important.
But that's exciting. You've met these mysterious figures.
I have. I sit there and I have like dinners with them, and that's also surreal, I have to say. That is also surreal. Yeah, and they're real people. And they're real down-to-earth people, and it's really, really nice to kind of, get a first-hand view of what life is like when you're an Oscar-winning actress, and you're contemplating what your next movie is going to be, and the things that help them make that decision.
And then Prince turns up, obviously, halfway through, and says, "Do you mind if I play a few songs?" And you go, "Sure."
There were a lot of swear words. A lot of good, positive swear words came out of my mouth. And and then I didn't tell my sister. My sister was coming along to the premiere. And I didn't tell her till the last minute that we were going on to the after party and Prince was playing. And she's rung me up every day since saying, I'm still pinching myself. But what's really great is when you get, you know, other like Twitter peeps, other Twitter celebs who are saying, my God, that rocked. That was like, you really pulled it out the bag there. We love that he loved the film. And we love that he loved the film so much that he tweets about it.
Yeah, that's a real power.
That's a real power.
You wrote, I understand, was it 17 draft iterations? I wondered if that was quite a big challenge within that.
Well, in the end, it ended up being 18 drafts because after I decided I wanted to reshoot my ending. And so in post-production, right before we did a test screening, I was granted the permission by the financiers, and so I had to then rewrite the ending. So it became 18 drafts. But absolutely, I wanted there to be no one homogenous view of Dido, response, reaction. And because I didn't want this to be a Cinderella story where Dido Bell is having to compel people to love her and find her place in the household. She goes into that household and frankly she's loved, and that's what all of the history shows. But we know it can't have been easy. I was making a commercial movie to a large extent, but it can't have been an easy ride. And so Miranda Richardson's family, Lady Ashford's family, have to represent all these different ideas of her. You know, the mother who is cash money, literally, is the currency that she operates with, literally. And, you know, in many ways, Belle could be any colour. if she has the money that will secure her son. You know, for Tom Felton's character, Tom Felton's character very much represents fear of chaos, a need for the rules. What will happen if change comes about? And, you know, for him, he's fighting the fact that he actually finds her beautiful, because to find her beautiful would be to destabilize the status quo, would be to destabilize those kind of families. And then there's the brother who just, I mean, genuinely is, he genuinely loves her, but he doesn't know how to love her. He doesn't know how to love her for who she is, rather than in spite of who she is. So I love them as a family. I mean, I think when you're working with these characters, you have to love them all, the good ones and the bad ones, you know, and I love them.
It's like how actors will never sort of talk about their characters as villains.
Yeah, you have to be the hero in your own story.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's quite true. Important.
I gather our lead actress, who is astonishing in this film, was attached to this project for years and years and years and years. Seven is what I have here.
Yes, yes and no.
Yes and no.
Yes and no, in the sense that Damien Jones, my wonderful, beloved producer, loves to give the script out to absolutely everybody all of the time. So, you know, first draft comes out and he'll start giving that script out. So Gugu and Barta Raw actually, yes, knew about the story before I even came on board, in the sense that she knew that Damien was trying to tell a story about Dido Bell's history. So she knew about that. She knew about the film as it was going through its various, the script as it was going through its various incarnations. And when, and then she finally came to meet me, I think it was 2009 or 2010, I'm trying to work it out, when I came on board to kind of take over and really sort of supplant my vision on what I thought the story behind the painting would be. Now, I knew her, however, having said that, because she came to audition for me for a movie called Where Hands Touch, which collapsed in 2009. It's a movie I've written and will direct due to the financial crisis. And that will now be made in 2015. Mm. So I met her and, oh my God, she walks into the room and, I mean, really stupidly, because I couldn't think of anything else to say, because her beauty is like show-stopping. I said, my goodness, aren't you cute as a button? And then I suddenly thought, well, God, imagine if I was a man and I'd said that. A male director as she walks into the room. She was very good to me, though. She didn't embarrass me. And then she started reading for that role, and she was fantastic. So it is true that Damien and I always kept her abreast of what was happening. She was always, she read every single draft that I did, thank God. And she saw the story emerging. She's smart, really smart. She knew what kind of story I wanted to tell. And I always say, I think we made great partners in crime, because it was a collaboration. You know, I was speaking to you guys earlier about when I was a kid and an actress doing Grange Hill. And for me, directors, producers, they were authority figures who told you what to do and you just did what they said. Whereas this was a collaboration and a trust. You know, she had a great trust in me, which is, you know, something that often takes time. You have to earn, particularly on your second film. Mm. But she had that trust, hopefully because she'd seen what I'd done with the scripts, and that helped.
Just Say No. Do you remember your lyrics in Just Say No? Do you remember? And
be
also,
who you are and stand up proud. You can hear me going, say no, because I had to go. Can I just tell you, back then I had such a good voice that after it was done, I had to go and do some additional recording with a couple of the other people that have good voices and just go over everybody else's voice.
Wow.
Had to do that with the album as well. And of course, Maluki Christie, who was Kevin, who did the wickedest, wickedest rap.
Do you remember the rap?
So what was it made you do it? You had no something. Was the first the taste, then the something. Knowing with your main man, you didn't really understand. After all you did for me, expected me to shake your hand.
Just Say No.
Maluki's listening to this. I'm so embarrassed. I'm sorry, Maluki. I totally screwed up your rap, which he wrote himself. It was absolutely brilliant. But yeah, I was both proud and embarrassed.
I would love it.
That time in my life.
Would have loved it if Prince did a cover of that at the end of your party for Belle. That would have made me so happy.
Can I tell you something? The woman, oh, Kate, I'm sorry, but I have to say this. The woman who runs Fox UK, Kate Gardner, told me the other night, Fox Searchlight UK, that is, and that they are the people distributing the film. She told me that was the first record she ever bought. I know, I felt so proud. I felt so proud. My first record, by the way, was Jamaica Funk. I just thought I'd get that out. That's how old I am. Okay. they were fun days. And of course, I learned so much that I bring to what I do today. Yeah. So all important.
And that ended with you touring the White House, didn't it? As a 16-year-old, a bunch of you went out to America, Yankee Stadium, the White House.
Yankee Stadium, where we performed Just Say No. I love telling my husband I've performed in Yankee Stadium. I don't think he believes me. He's Danish, has no concept of Grange Hill whatsoever, and I really think he doesn't believe me. And occasionally on a Sunday, I go on YouTube and go, look, see, he's not impressed. It was the first time, really, that I did lots of this kind of thing that we're all doing now, where I sat and got interviewed and had to try and sound a bit intelligent. And we did Washington and New York. It was my first time in the Big Apple, and first time away from my parents. I know. So it was, trust me, and at 16, you didn't need to have a chaperone. So while the other 13, 14-year-olds would have to stay home in the evening, me and a couple of other 16-year-olds, we'd go out roaming. It was great fun.
God, what an experience.
It was an experience. It was an experience. Not even to be repeated in many ways, even in a podcast where you can say bastard, but we got up to lots of things and it was great.
Is it true that you were working on the script for Belle on your wedding day?
Yes, it's 100% true. So my stepdaughter was staying with me in what was going to be our honeymoon suite. My husband had been sent, he was staying at a different hotel, and I was supposed to have delivered before we travelled to Paris. It was in Paris. Mm. But when you're putting your wedding together, you get behind. And I was a little bit mortified because I hadn't really been a screenwriter that's usually behind on stuff. I thought, oh, well, I'll just carry on working into the night for a couple of nights and I'll get this finished. On the morning of my wedding day, I hadn't done it. I hadn't finished it. So I wrote to Damien Jones. I still have the email, and said, Damien, it's like 4:05 in the morning. I've been working all night, but I'm getting married in a few hours. And please, can I deliver, you know, after I get married? And he's like, please go and get married. So I then went to sleep. Woke up and my stepdaughter said to me, you look horrible. Go back to sleep for some more hours and I will order you breakfast, you know, once you wake up. So I went back to sleep again. I did walk down the aisle with the biggest bags under my eyes, and I did have to spend most of my honeymoon in Morocco completing that draft. And my husband has a photograph of me, again, at 4 in the morning, going down to reception, because it was the only place you could get a signal, and pressing send so I could send the script. But it was, it was pretty... Yeah.
That's professionalism.
It was. That evening we got married, because we did get married in the evening in Paris. Up until last Thursday was the best moment of my life. You have now been usurped, and Prince has taken your place. He has given me the best moment of my life.
Like, I know you got a plane to catch, so we should probably let you go.
I know. I'm going to sunny Scotland, to Scone Palace, the home of where the painting of Dido Belle and Elizabeth Murray is hanging, and I'm excited.
Wow, okay. Is that the first time you'll have seen it in the canvas?
No, I saw it with my production designer, and tough filmmakers that we are, we both burst into tears when we saw it. He, with his 6'1" self, Simon Bowles, who loves it when I call him my gorgeous Simon Bowles, which he is. Yeah, it's luminous, it's gorgeous, it's beautiful. It's everything I hoped it would be in many ways. And you know, the great thing about great art, not to get too artsy, if I can say that, is that it inspires and it evokes. Yeah. And that's exactly what it did for me with this film. It inspired me and it evoked emotions in me that allowed me to be able to make this film. And so, you know, I will go and see it again. Yeah, I can't wait for it to also come back down to London. Mm. So that, you know, it can be in Kenwood House for a while again as well.
What, with you tomorrow?
Yes, under my arm.
Under your arm.
On EasyJet.
Everyone listening to this, do go and Google it, because it is truly an amazing picture.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming to see us in our very own offices. We've given you a copy of Heat, so enjoy that for the plane
ride.
I'm
going to enjoy that for my plane ride. I love it. Heat is... It's the quintessential magazine that has to come with me on a plane ride. Mm. Thank you for having me. I've loved it.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okie dokie, let's start this week's reviews with Belle. We've drafted in Alan Hansen and Mark Lawrenson to give their verdicts on the week's films as well. No, we haven't. Apparently we don't have the budget. We'll have to make do with the usual crew then. So, Ali, start us off on Belle, please.
Okay, sure. So, as you've heard from the interview you've just enjoyed, well done for enjoying it, this is a historical fiction, essentially. So it's not about...
He's very spiky today, isn't he?
Like a hedgehog, yeah. It's a historical fiction, so it's not actually about what necessarily occurred. So before you go, oh, wow, did that really happen? No, for the most part it didn't. It's the story of this... What?
Well, it is sort of grounded in history.
It's grounded in history, but like the actual occurrences,
yeah,
the
story.
Marry so-and-so and lovers, oh, right, okay, whatever. It's historical fiction, so there was this mixed race girl who was born to a admiral in the British Navy, who was brought into his uncle's house, who happened to be the Lord Chief Justice. This was in 1779, I think, around about that period. And she becomes part of their home, part of their family. She can't have dinner with her family publicly, and she is somewhat removed from the rest of her community, but she is by and large within her own family and small world loved and happy. And it's a real rarity. The dramatic coincidence is that the Lord Chief Justice has to decide a very important case where, I was about to say Zorg is not the right word, but it was the Zong disaster, essentially, or the Zong incident, where a slave ship was travelling to America, and they'd made some bad decisions in where they were going and had run out of water, and what they decided to do was take the slaves on board the ship and throw them overboard because they thought they could get the insurance money back, whereas if they'd just carried on and these diseased slaves had got to America, they couldn't have sold them for as much money, which is awful and horrible and just, it's terrible. But he has to preside over whether that is actually fraud. Their cost of their lives are truly worth a human's life, that sort of thing. So that's going on, and you know, this guy has to preside over that case whilst he has a mixed race adopted daughter, essentially, in his life. Gugu Mbatha-Raw plays Belle, this beautiful, she's absolutely knock your socks off beautiful girl who treads a fine line between wanting to remove this social impediment and be herself and be true to who she is. Through essentially her father dying at sea, it happens early on, she inherits wealth, and then suddenly the likes of Tom Felton and other young men in her society take an interest in her because it's all about horse trading and who are you marrying and what's going on. So she does a very fine job. I think it's a very handsome, beautiful, well-directed, somewhat modest period piece that deals with some difficult topics in an approachable and quite commercial way, I should say. It did quite well in the US, and I hope it does well in the UK too. Emma Asante is lovely, as you've just heard, and I wish her the very, very best, and I hope she goes on to do other great things. This, for my money, succeeds at what it wants to do. It wants to talk about some difficult topics in an approachable way, but doesn't necessarily go too deep or really come head to head with a very, very difficult topic, not just slavery, which it doesn't just concentrate on, but the kind of Jane Austeniness of society in that time. Great supporting cast all round, Miranda Richardson, Tom Wilkinson, I mean, the list goes on and on. It's I don't think there's anybody's really a weak point, but yeah, it doesn't fully connect with me, but shows a lot of promise and has a very good few things to say.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. We've given it 3 stars, and I would probably go along with that. I thought it's a very handsome film, and it's a very heartfelt film, and it's got a lot of and a real star-making turn, I think, for Gugu Mbatha-Raw. It's really incredibly charismatic and magnetic on screen, and I think a lot of people can enjoy it. I mean it's very reductive, but it's sort of got elements of Jane Austen, elements of Amistad. They sometimes gel slightly awkwardly around the kind of key law case, but it's a lovely period piece, and if that's your sort of thing, I'd definitely recommend it.
Yes, I think that's fair. If you're into this sort of affair, you will not be disappointed. It delivers, and it's very touching at times. There are certainly scenes which really get you. So yeah, you look forward to it. I would happily go take my mum to go and see this. I know that sounds a little bit like, what a compliment, but I really would, and I think you have a good conversation about it afterwards.
Okay, so it's 3 stars for Belle, which is a recommendation, as we always say on the podcast. Very, very handsome, lavishly mounted British film. Do go along if you can and show it your support. Next up is T.S. Spivet. What are our thoughts on this one, Philcat?
Well, we talked about directors that we feel like had their best work ahead of them last week on the podcast, and I suspect this might be a director whose potentially his best work may be behind him. On the basis of his last few films, Jean-Pierre Jeunet, doesn't look like he's got necessarily another Delicatessen or another Amelie in him. One of those, even Amelie, which I think people see as quite a sort of candied fairy tale story, has some sharp edges. This is a film that is very much a sort of smooth, rounded thing that you can glide over. It's a story, basically. It's kind of a coming of age tale for this young kid, and he's very endearing. They kind of, I think is it Wyoming or somewhere in the Midwest,
Montana.
Yeah, the old West, basically, the frontier, but it's set in contemporary times, and he lives there with his mum, Helena Bonham Carter, his father, who's like a vestige of the Old West. He still wants to be a cowboy, and the world's moved on. And the film sort of taps into that a little bit, the idea that, you know, the world moves apace, and you have to try and find your place in it. And this kid, sure enough, is some kind of prodigy. He's an inventor and is a sort of little genius, really, and he wins a prestigious award in Washington. His parents won't let him go, so he sets off across country, planes, trains, and automobiles style, to get to the award prize giving. And I don't want to go any further into the story than that, because it is a sort of a discovery tale. The things I really liked about it, it has that Genet inventiveness. He has a real sort of lightness of touch about, you know, creating the production design and the way that he sort of pieces the frame together, with stitches them together with, I mean, something Guillermo del Toro does very, very well as well, with sort of inventions and Heath Robinson, I almost said Heath Ledger, Heath Robinson sort of touches. And I always love that. And I like the way, the cleverness of the sort of opening credits and the way that he establishes the world. But I think as a coming of age story about a kid, it's no Stand By Me, really. It's not got that kind of emotional core to it. And our reviewer makes that point, really, that it probably falls down on the emotion, and the ending I didn't think worked all that brilliantly. We gave it 3 stars.
I mean it is very pleasant, I should say that, and it looks spectacular. The shots of the American scenery as he sort of travels cross country are absolutely astonishing, and the kid himself, Kyle Catlett, who plays T.S. Spivet, is wonderful. I think he's really, really good, and it's a role that actually asks quite a lot of him, and he's a little bit younger, as you heard probably in the interview. Genet was looking for someone, you know, a bit older and a bit more kind of robust, and this kid just won him over with sheer talent, which is lovely.
Is good. There's a lot of things to like about this film, and there's a lot of things that perhaps don't work quite so well, and I hope Genet, you know, maybe he just needs that story or that script, and maybe he does have a real sort of another masterpiece in him, but this probably isn't it.
Yeah. Do you think he's turning into a bit of a journeyman director?
I think you just won the podcast with that, my friend. No, that's it. We'll just wrap up. We won't even bother discussing the next film because we can't top that. We've left. Everyone's left. Just press
that was
stop.
Ali. He's retired.
Mic drop.
Yeah. 3 stars for T.S. Spivet, which was originally titled
The Young and Prodigious T.S. Spivet.
The Young and Prodigious T.S. Spivet. I can see why they dropped that. Okay, T.S. Spivet. And now, next, grab a sofa. Don't grab a sofa, grab a cushion from a sofa and hide behind it, for we have the scary film Oculus, which stars Karen Gillan of Doctor Who fame as a young woman determined to prove Mirror is haunted. It was a huge hit in the States. Will it fare equally well here? Helen, Karen Gillan of this podcast.
Oh, thank you. I think it deserves to, certainly. Wait, do you mean my hair is falling out? Anyway, yes, this is the story of, it's a brother and sister story, really. So Karen Gillan is the older girl, and Brenton Thwaite, who you may recently have seen in Maleficent as the sort of Prince Philip character, is her younger brother. Now, about 10 years before this starts, there was a tragedy in their home. Their parents both died. Mm-hmm. Since then, he's basically been in therapy, being told that you just imagined all this crazy stuff. What happened was very, very sad, but basically it was a family tragedy. She, however, was just, you know, grew up and has gotten a job in an auction house and has sort of apparently been dealing with it. But when he emerges from his long years in therapy, discovers that she's still obsessed with it and is determined to go back to the house, confront this evil once and for all. Mm-hmm. Kind of unfolds in both time frames, really, because you go back to see what happened, years before, with the younger versions of these two, Annalise Basso and Garrett Ryland, played the young versions of their characters, and they are phenomenal. And also what happened then with their parents. And it's really pretty creepy, unsettling stuff. It gets under your skin. There are a couple of really kind of gory moments, but a lot more emphasis on sort of traditional scares, a lot more emphasis on kind of, you know, real kind of horror mainstream stuff, but done exceptionally well. It's not just sort of jump scares for the sake of jump scares. Mm-hmm. And it kind of gets under your skin here, and I think there are some surprises here as this goes up forward. It also has some of the best use of flashbacks that I have ever seen. It's really, really well done in that case. And I think director Mike Flanagan is one to watch. This was made on a fairly low budget. I think if somebody gives him some money, he's going to, you know, shake things up.
Absolutely. 22 jump scares.
he built this on the back of a short he did, which is called Oculus Chapter 3, The Man with the Plan, which is available. You can see that if you're curious. I'm not a big horror buff, but having watched this film, I can heartily recommend it. It is unflinching and edgy and a bit dirty, and I kind of liked it. And Karen Gillan's fantastic. She does the best American accent. You think a lot of people who've been in Doctor Who go on to do kind of a bit of nothing and then occasionally would appear on, you know, Strictly Come Dancing a few years later, but not her. And she's really hopefully going to go really far. She's got this new American TV show coming out, which she got put to series, which scares the heck out of me, and for different reasons to Oculus. But it's called Selfie, and it's about this self-obsessed young girl in America. So that's doing well. There's a lengthy interview with her. I managed to talk to her for a little while and wrote it all down because she's thoroughly, delightfully bonkers. And to hear her pitch what the British version of Barbie should look like and be called, you can go there. You can go there. It's on the website, on the homepage. Go check it out.
Fantastic. So 4 stars then.
4 stars, definitely.
4 stars for Oculus. In many ways, the film of the week.
Yeah.
I guess. Fantastic. Also out this week is Atom McGowan's Devil's Knot, which stars Colin Firth and Reese Witherspoon. And it's 2 stars for that, which is another disappointment for Atom McGowan. His most recent film, The Captive, did not go down well. Road is about the Northwest 200, the motorcycle race, the legendary motorcycle race, and the incredible legacy of the Northern Irish Dunlop family, including the magnificent late and lamented Joey Dunlop. And now in the wings on the world stage takes you behind the scenes of Kevin Spacey's Richard III production, which played at the Old Vic and then around the world for 10 months back in 2011. And both of those are fine, okay documentaries, especially if you're interested in the subject matter. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by Jon Favreau, director of Chef, and Ansel Elgort, the young star of the phenomenon that is The Fault in Our Stars. Until then, it's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Ali.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to find Dave Spikey and paint him blue. See you next week. Bye.